Well, certainly we want to resist this idea that's coming out of the Biden administration that we need like more domestic terrorism laws, that we need to further strengthen political policing. So we certainly don't want to do that because we know that in the long run, those new powers are going to be used against the left, not against the right. You know, there'll be some symbolic rounding up of a few, you know, wingnut extremists. And then very quickly, those resources will pivot to going after, you know, black identity extremists and Antifa and all these code words for, you know, what is this emerging left movement in the United States. So that's the first thing. We don't want to fall down that. We don't want to make that mistake, which a lot of liberals have fallen into, right? That they're embracing their retributive impulses of, you know, justice equals punishment.
Hey, everybody. Thank you very much for tuning in. In this episode, I speak with Alex Vitale. Alex is professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College and a visiting professor at London South Bank University. He has spent the last 30 years writing about policing and consults both police departments and human rights organizations internationally. He is the author of two books, the first being City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics, and The End of Policing. And the last time I spoke with Alex, and I did speak with him one time before, was just after he had released The End of Policing, published through Verso Books. This is the second interview that I've conducted over the past week regarding the Capitol siege, the first being with Spencer Sunshine, who's a researcher of far-right movements. And I really wanted to talk with Alex again to discuss the policing element of this. One of the things that has come up since the Capitol siege was just seeing the really abysmal police response to these people, these MAGA chuds, as I like to call them, storming the Capitol. The amount of police that were there to secure the Capitol was, I think, cut in half. I think it was like just dramatically lower than it normally would be for such a thing. And also considering how we all knew, or at least it was really out in the open, that there was going to be a big rally and that there's a lot of anger that's been fomented by Trump. And just, yeah, we all knew what this was building towards. We all knew that it was something like this could happen. So why weren't there enough police? Why did we see videos of police seemingly helping or letting in these people into the Capitol? All of these things, right? We had all these questions once this happened. And I wanted to ask Alex about this because I'm like, what did you see when you saw these videos of police letting in people, taking selfies with some of these people as well, but also seeing like a lot of these police were fighting really, really hard to keep these people back. There seems to have just been a lot of chaos and mismanagement of resources, disorganization, and so on. So I just wanted to get his understanding of this, because something that I really want to address with him is that, I mean, obviously he wrote a book called The End of Policing, right? So we're talking about the defunding of policing, police departments across the U.S., which of course we know that the police brutality issue was raised this last year, especially in the wake of the murder of George Floyd and all of the uprisings and protests and demonstrations we saw across the United States since then. Obviously, we're having a national conversation about the role that police play or should play in communities, their relationship with communities of color, with black communities, the, of course, issues surrounding white supremacy, what the police represent as far as that goes. So obviously, we've been having this conversation for a while now, and it's very needed and it's a very important one. And I am definitely on Alex's side on this, which is to say we need to really keep on focusing on how we can make our community safer and moving away from this model that we've had for so long in this country regarding policing and the so-called criminal justice system and the carceral state and like all of these intersecting issues. When we have this conversation or when we look at the images and videos and all of the information that's coming out about the Capitol siege, a couple things come out, like really stood out to me, which is one, for being supposedly pro-police, these people were beating the shit out of police officers. So it's like, okay, that's interesting. The second thing that comes out, of course, is how complicit were the police really in this event? Alex provides his perspective on that. And also just stepping away from this conversation a little bit, because this narrative has formed around this event, which is liberals and leftists even being like, yeah, you know, fuck these people. They need to be tried and put in prison. And, you know, what they did was seditious, traitorous, all of these different things. And we need to really reflect on the fact that this event, just like after 9/11, right? When 9/11 happened, that's when the Patriot Act was passed, which led to this never-ending war on terror that is still continuing. It's been 20 years since then, and we're still in the middle of all of these, you know, occupations and invasions of other countries. So it's like, how did, and also, of course, the ramping up of the surveillance state and everything else that came with it. So we can anticipate that when Biden gets into power, which I'm recording this on the 19th, so the inauguration is tomorrow, that he, just like pretty much every president before him, is going to use this as a means to pass legislation to further enhance the surveillance state, policing, and so on. So we need to be, as leftists, very careful about how we're talking about this subject. You know, it's like, oh, we hate the police when they attack us, but as soon as they attack people we are diametrically opposed to, then we're like, yeah, round them up and put them in jail. Like, that's very inconsistent, and we need to be much more consistent. And I am seeing a lot of people like being very careful in how they talk about it. I'm not trying to be disparaging of everybody, obviously, but I am seeing a lot of this type of language being used by people that, you know, have been known to say fuck the police. It's just kind of interesting to see how people are right now. So I ask Alex if he could step outside of these narratives that have been constructed over the past couple weeks or less since this event, and just say, like, look, like, this is a bigger subject than just whether, you know, the police were under-resourced or not, or like what was going on inside to allow this to happen. Obviously, these are important questions, but if we're really going to move towards defunding and abolishing, ultimately abolishing the police as we understand it to be today, we need to keep our eye on the prize, our eye on the ball, and yeah, just understand like what the police's role really is in spite of who is attacking them. So right now it might be far-right nationalists that are worrisome, but we look at the past year with the protests that emerged after George Floyd, and we can just see how the police have reacted to the left. So we need to be very careful in how we talk about this and what we're really supporting here in the wake of this event. Because like I said, this will be used as a means to further consolidate power, to enhance policing power, surveillance powers here in the United States domestically. Yeah, I just have Alex just explain all this and provide his deep analysis and perspective to this whole situation. So yeah, I mean, this interview is relatively short compared to what I normally release as far as, you know, interview length, but Alex was able to just to cover all the issues really concisely and very, very well. And I really enjoy Alex's work. I really recommend checking out his book, The End of Policing. I think he mentioned at the very end of this interview that they're releasing a second edition, which I think is very, very good considering everything that's been going on over the past year. I would ask that you check out his book, The End of Policing, published at Verso Books. I will be putting a link to that in the description. You can also just learn more about Alex and his work at alex-vitali.info. Everything you need to know will be there. And yeah, I'll be putting all the other resources that are relevant to this interview down in the description of this episode. If you would like to learn more about my podcast, you can do that by going to my website, lastbornin-the-wilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support this work monetarily, there's a couple ways to do that. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal or Venmo. You can go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast to make a donation through that, or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. If you would like to support my work on a regular monthly basis or on a yearly basis, that is an option now on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/lastbornthewilderness, you can contribute there, and by doing that, you'll gain early access to these interviews before they're released publicly, and you'll gain some other exclusive content there as well. Thank you to everybody that supports my work. We are now in 2021. We're on the verge. We're kind of at the end of the Trump era, so to speak. Although I don't think he's going to go away quietly as he leaves his role as president. But nonetheless, we are entering into a new phase, I think, here politically in the United States, and we'll just see how this all plays out. And of course, I'll be continuing to do my work into the near and distant future. And so to everybody that supports my work, thank you very much. I love you. I see you. Thank you. All right, everybody. Without any further delay, here is my interview with Professor Alex Vitali.
Well, Alex, or should I say Professor Vitali? I'm not sure.
Alex is fine.
Alex, I always wonder, what's the proper way to address people? And some people get a little offended if I don't call them by their first name, or if I call them, Professor so-and-so or whatever. So I just always have to clarify or ask. It's always just a preference at this point, I think. But anyway, Alex, thank you very much for joining me. I interviewed you 2 years ago, I think. It was a little over 2 years ago. You had just released your book, The End of Policing. And I've always been meaning to, circle back around and have you back on. And then I was just, of course, with everything that happened at the Capitol in the last, it was a little over a week ago now. So much of the conversation has been around policing, it seems. And I really thought that having you come back on and just discuss your work regarding policing, and how this fits into this whole narrative that seems to be constructed right now about the police response at the Capitol with the siege, and all of that. I just really wanted to get your perspectives on that whole situation. Really the first question I have for you is when you first started, I think everybody on that day, on the 6th, we were just sort of watching, images and videos coming in. Police were being overwhelmed. There weren't enough police at the Capitol. People were confused about what was happening. People were storming it, attacking police, getting into the Capitol building. It just seemed so chaotic and so mismanaged. But based on just your initial observations that day, what stood out to you in regards to policing, at least?
Well, there started to be these little clips of videos on Twitter and whatnot where people were focused on police complicity with the demonstrators. Oh, look, they let him in through this barricade, or they let him in through this door. Mm-hmm. And that didn't seem quite right to me. And so I started to try to look more carefully at these videos. And what seemed clear to me is that in most of these videos, what police were doing was basically a kind of strategic retreat. Mm. In the face of the fact that they were being surrounded. Mm. So they opened up a barricade, but only because the demonstrators had already gotten through in other places and were filling in behind them, which you don't want that if you're a police officer. Sure. In a situation like this. And so they're like, okay, we're falling back. It's hard to analyze every single one of the videos out of context, but what was also clear to me was that there was tremendous resistance by the police to the crowd. There was intense fighting.
Yeah.
With significant injuries to police and demonstrators. This was a pitched battle. And so to focus a narrative around, the police let them in. Mm-hmm. Based on these videos, just clearly didn't seem to be right to me that at least on the ground, in the moment, the police were trying to defend these positions as best they could.
Right.
Then we got to think about, what happened such that we found ourselves in this situation in the first place, right? So there were clearly police failures, and I think politics played a role in that, but that doesn't really explain. You can't explain that in terms of individual officers on the front lines.
Right. Yeah, I feel and this clue to myself, I was first to jump in and assert my thought on what was happening, which is, of course, the police are going to work with these people. Of course, they're going to take selfies with them. Of course, they're going to let them in the Capitol. It's there was that mentality that I had. And then I think once more information came in and we really had a better context, a bigger context of what happened, it changed a bit. And I realized that my own biases were getting in the way of just, analyzing the situation accurately. So I guess now that it's been over 7 days or 8, 9 days since that happened, with more information coming out, what stood out to you now since then?
Well, first, it's clear that a lot of police are sympathetic to these right-wing movements. Mm-hmm. the conspiracy theories, the nationalism, the authoritarianism, the racism. We know there were a lot of off-duty police in the crowd, and we know that many of the police on duty that day, especially among the Capitol Police, less so among the D.C. Metropolitan Police, you know, were sympathetic, including the officer that was killed. Mm. But we're learning more about what was happening up the chain of command.
Right.
Which is where the real problem is, right? The mm-hmm. decisions about deployments, about preparation. So you have, for instance, the now resigned head of the Capitol Police saying, I asked my superiors for authorization to bring in the National Guard preemptively and, you know, have them available in the Capitol, and I was turned down. Mm. So in this case, his immediate superiors were the sergeants at arm for the House and the Senate. And these are, you know, political appointments. And these folks said, no, we don't want to see military troops in the Capitol. And we now know that the mayor of D.C. played a role in shaping the deployment. After so much criticism about the militarized response to the Black Lives Matter protests, she's like, well, we want to take a softer touch. We don't want to seem like we're a militarized city. Uh-huh. And so she instructs, you know, the Metropolitan Police to try to take a slightly softer touch and to not pre-deploy, you know, heavily militarized units. So these are political decisions happening at a high level. This is not about individual officer discretion, about whether or not to take a selfie with someone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of my concerns is that, you know, what happens in these situations is that members of Congress, political leaders, the Biden administration are going to throw some demonstrators and some cops under the bus by ramping up criminalization of dissent. And then they're going to wipe their hands of the thing and say, you know, well, there's justice now. And in the process, they're going to shut down the conversation about high-level political complicity with this, including members of Congress, you know, who are supporting these movements, maybe acting in concert with them, maybe actually involved in planning. There was some hint of this, and I don't have any evidence to substantiate this. This is stuff that should be investigated. And my concern is that a lot of this is going to get swept under the rug, as it often does.
Why would it be swept under the rug, though? I feel like this would be a really good case for impeachment, as well as just trying to rid our political system of I guess the Trumpists, those that are working. I mean, like, they actively, like, were encouraging call it insurrection or coup attempts. I mean, like, you would think, I guess, I would just assume Democrats would be like, all right, this is the thing that's going to allow us to basically purge our system of these folks that really don't believe in democracy or believe in this process. And we can use this as a really good example of just how traitorous they are. You know, the language they would use maybe would be traitorous, and we can rid them. So, like, I guess maybe my question more is, like, the way you framed it is, like, what does that ultimately serve for, say, the Democrats or whoever?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, the signal from the Biden administration was really clear right away. They did not favor impeachment. They don't favor, you know, the Senate removing him from office. They are heavily invested in producing this discourse around being moderate, reaching across the aisle. Mm. They don't want to inflame partisan difference.
Yeah.
So they're like, we're going to be post-Trump, and now everyone can just work together. We're going to compromise, which, of course, what that is really about is capitulating to the idea that, well, we can't really give you anything. Mm. We're not really going to give you the kind of COVID relief you need. we're not really going to give you real access to healthcare. We're not really going to give you, you know, free tuition or substantial reductions in debt, you know, in school debt. We're going to give you a few symbolic things, but our job is to hold the line, to be reasonable, to be moderate, so that we can continue in power and basically continue this larger democratic strategy of appealing to the wealthy to join the democratic coalition by selling out the poor and working class folks. So a purge of extremist Republicans in the Congress is seen as too divisive.
Right.
So you have the squad taking a different approach, right? So Cori Bush from St. Louis says, actually, I'm going to introduce a measure to expel every member of Congress who lied about the election, you know, who facilitated these conspiracy theories. And of course, the House leadership, the moderate House leadership, is completely shutting that down.
That's amazing. It's amazing that we could have, like, quite literally this situation that we're in currently, and still, they're doing that. I don't know. It just sort of points to just sort of a real lack of. I don't know. It just feels like history is repeating itself a little bit. Like, we can kind of look to parallels to previous examples of dictatorships or maybe fascist movements rising in liberal democracies. And it always seems like the liberals are the ones that kind of don't really see the writing on the wall, and they don't make the right decisions when it's actually really, really important to make those right decisions.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, the concern here is that the failure of the Democrats to do anything substantial to help working people, and just overall questions of you know, equity and justice, is going to drive more people into the extremist right. And that, you know, the real risk is that we'll get a real fascist in 4 years, you know, and someone who's not a clown.
Right.
And who actually knows how to operate the levers of government. I mean, it's important to keep in mind how ineffective Trump was. Ultimately. I mean, he had certain horrible things he did, of course, and remaking the judiciary and stuff along the border, separating families. You know, that's all horrible, but it could have been much worse. And his sort of clownish you know, hate speech and authoritarianism, you know, cut him off from certain kinds of government actors and elite interests who weren't quite ready to go down that road with him. And we see even more of those people jettisoning him now at the 11th hour.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think what I'm seeing with the Republicans, I feel like I think there's going to be there's definitely going to be long-term consequences to this. It feels like there's a real schism that's emerged within the Republican Party. Everything just feels very tenuous. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't have any ability to see that, of course, but it just feels like this is just a great fracturing that's happening, you know?
The question is how to capitalize on it, right? I think you're right. The extremist movements in particular are under assault ideologically and from the criminal justice state, right? But they have very, very broad, deep support. You know, these movements are quite robust. So what can we do to drive a wedge between them? And it's not clear the Democrats have a real strategy. Their strategy is to appeal to the middle. Right, to make nice with the moderate Republicans in hopes that that will pull them away from the extremists.
Right.
But that doesn't, I'm not sure that's going to be sufficient. Because what we saw is that these moderate Republicans will embrace a Trump figure in a heartbeat if they think it'll get them some more votes.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like we've crossed a certain threshold already, or a certain kind of, there's a certain, it's like we've crossed the Rubicon or something. Like, I think we're already past that point. You know, centrist politics just doesn't seem viable, or even strategically, like, it doesn't make sense, to me at least, and just observing it. But I really want to frame, because this whole conversation around the policing at the Capitol, you know, it felt like there was a dichotomy there, or like a split where it's like, oh, look, you want to defund the police? You know, like, what are you thinking? Like, we needed more police there. Like, we need more police, more funding to make sure this doesn't ever happen again. And then you've got the other side, which is, of course, pointing to, well, actually, like, you know, see how they treated them, these white, mostly white people trying to lay siege to the Capitol, invading the Capitol. If those were people of color, you know, just compare this to the Black Lives Matter protests earlier this year. So there just seems to be this, like, you know, the narrative is still there between the two. And I'm just wondering, like, how does that fit into your analysis of policing in general, and like how we can approach this particular event through a lens that, you know, you've provided through your work?
Well, I think it's clear that the preparation for the protest was inadequate to secure the Capitol because of political sympathies among political and policing elites, you know, to this movement. Whether it was the kind of somewhat unexamined diminishing of the threat that's associated with right-wing movements compared to exaggerating the threat that's associated with left-wing movements. Mm-hmm. So there's always some of that. But, or whether it was a more conscious discounting of the threat. So we don't know that. We need more investigation, and we may never know, you know, what was really going on in people's heads and in some closed door meetings. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's interesting, though, is to see folks who were at the center of this kind of Blue Lives Matter movement literally beating police officers to death.
Yeah.
And there was a nice piece by Ryan Cooper in the publication The Week that really talks about, you know, that Blue Lives Matter for these extremist movements was never about blue lives. It was just a tactic to attack black lives. Mm. And that as soon as blue lives got in the way of their agenda, they were very happy to throw blue lives under the bus as well. Mm-hmm. They didn't really have the interests of police as human beings in mind. At least significant sections of them really didn't. Mm-hmm. That if police stood in the way of their kind of authoritarian agenda or their, you know, completely insane crackpot conspiracy theories, that police, you know, could be neutralized, liquidated as much as any other group they're against.
Mm-hmm. So what is the solution to this? So if you have tens of thousands of raging white people attempting to storm a Capitol, and you're approaching it from an abolitionist or a defund the police perspective, what would be like the bigger question that you would maybe want to ask people or have people think about in regards to this event?
Well, certainly we want to resist this idea that's coming out of the Biden administration that we need like more domestic terrorism laws. Mm-hmm. That we need to further strengthen political policing. Mm. So we certainly don't want to do that because we know that in the long run, those new powers are going to be used against the left, mm-hmm. not against the right. You know, there'll be some symbolic rounding up of a few, you know, wingnut extremists. And then very quickly, those resources will pivot to going after, you know, black identity extremists and Antifa and all these code words for, you know, what is this emerging left movement in the United States. So that's the first thing. We don't want to fall down that We don't want to make that mistake, which a lot of liberals have fallen into, right? That they're embracing their retributive impulses of, you know, justice equals punishment. I think, though, ultimately, this is about establishing, you know, an aspirational left politics that speaks to the alienation that is such fertile ground for these extremist right-wing movements who see nothing in the mainstream Democratic Party to appeal to them. And we know, for instance, that some folks on the margins of these extremist movements were quite sympathetic to, for instance, Bernie Sanders. That they would not have as easily fallen into all of these conspiracy theories and militant resistance if Bernie had been the nominee.
Right.
Because there was a sense in which he actually gave a shit about middle America and working people and was trying to figure something out and was going to like, and was not part of the centrist liberal permanent state establishment, that he was an outsider, you know, with independent credibility. Now, there are various reasons why Bernie was not able to pull that off. And it's not clear, you know, who's immediately in the wings. But I think that rather than focusing all our energy on picking the next presidential candidate, we need to be building the grassroots movements that will change the politics on the ground, that will create the possibility of someone stepping into that at some future date, whether it's AOC or some other member of the squad or someone, you know, coming out of these movements.
Well, what are like some of the next steps in defunding the police or police abolition? I mean, what are some like, because I think what people need is a demonstration, because they're so scared of the idea because they just haven't ever lived without police. They don't know what it's like. They think crime's going to skyrocket. You know, who's going to deal with these violent rioting protesters, whatever? Like, I mean, there's all of these scenarios that people will bring up when you say, like, yeah, I think we should really move towards defunding and abolishing the police as we understand it to be. And it's kind of hard because you do need to have a you need to like show people like actually what works and how we can get there. And so, I mean, yeah, like in your work, I mean, what have you observed as far as moving towards that? Like, what are some examples that we could point people towards as far as like how that would work?
Yeah, I think a lot of people see the movement only in terms of, you know, well, when was the last big street protest? And then if we don't see a street protest, well, then the movement must have collapsed. But this is far from true. I mean, I'm doing events every day across the country in cities where people are organizing. They're not necessarily doing daily protests, but they're organizing. They're in the communities talking to people about what we could do instead of policing to make these communities safer than they are right now, because that's really what the movement is calling for. It's not about punishing the police by taking their budgets away. It's about we need things in the communities to produce safety, and all the money goes to policing, and policing is part of the problem. So, you know, I was in Asheville, North Carolina this week, where for years, folks called for things like implicit bias training and body cameras. And folks have come to realize there that these things didn't help. And that instead, they want to talk about getting police out of the schools, creating alternative mental health responses so that police aren't involved. Creating community-based anti-violence programs. And that's what this movement looks like on the ground. It's people in the community talking to each other about what these alternative systems of public safety would look like. Not tomorrow we're going to flip some magical switch that doesn't exist and poof, there are no police and then we'll figure it out. No, we have this massive infrastructure of policing and we're going to start chipping away at it in a very methodical kind of way. Let's hire counselors, create restorative justice programs, and get rid of school police. Let's create community-based mental health services and clinical emergency response teams and get the police out of that. Right? Let's quit using police to manage homelessness and drugs. Let's turn these into housing and public health problems to be resolved by people who know how to manage those problems, right? Let's mobilize community resources instead of thinking the police can solve every problem. And I'm telling you, this coming year, when we go into the local budget season, we're just going to see hundreds of these movements across the country of communities saying, no, we don't want to hire more police. We want to hire more community workers and clinical workers. And I think this is, we're going to see some big victories.
That's good. So I guess in this this movement to defund police and reallocate resources, that's very much a grassroots thing versus, say, a overarching like national, I mean, it's a national project, I guess, but it doesn't require like a massive form of legislation to make it happen. It can be done on a like a city or state or just on a local level, right?
One of the challenges right now is that everyone has been so obsessed with Trump that everyone thinks politics is something you do every 4 years in relationship to the presidential election. And if you're really political, it's every 2 years when there are congressional elections. But policing is a local matter. And if we're going to rebuild the politics of the country, that has to happen at the local level, not in the halls of the Capitol. So there are some national efforts. You know, the Movement for Black Lives is supporting the BREATHE Act that came from Ayanna Pressley and other members of the squad, that would be a great intervention at the federal level. You know, and there's a movement to stop these federal police task forces that come in and flood cities and make a bunch of gang arrests or immigration arrests or drug arrests or whatever. But the real action is on the ground. It's about lobbying city council members and going to budget hearings at the local level. And I think that's where we're going to shift the politics of the country away from this moderate corporate-driven center to a real left-wing people-centered politics that actually cares about poor and working-class people, that actually cares about the long-term trajectory of the environment, that actually cares about addressing deep historical racial injustices, which the moderate wing of the Democratic Party is not really that interested in.
Yeah. Well, I think my final topic or question I wanted to get to, and circling back to, you know, there is, I was reading an article last night about what, you know, Biden, what a domestic terrorism bill would look like under the Biden administration. And they're like, it doesn't look good because Biden was actually one of the architects of the Patriot Act after 9/11, because they based that off of a previous bill that he had been a big part of writing back in, I think, the mid-90s. I think it was after the Timothy McVeigh Oklahoma City bombing. I think he drafted something then. So he's obviously very much in favor of this kind of broad, like, domestic terror bill, like, you know, let's make sure this kind of thing never happens. But as you pointed to earlier, this would be directed towards leftist movements, most definitely. So I would say, like, leftists should not get in the trap that, you know, yeah, they're maybe responding to this particular event at the Capitol where a bunch of right-wing fanatics stormed the Capitol. And yeah, it would be great if we could put a lid on that using the police, but without recognizing how much that could be turned against them. So yeah, I guess I'm asking, like, what could we anticipate with a bill like that? Like, what would be, I don't know, I mean, we can't know for certain, but like, what would you expect to come up in that? And also, how would like defunding the police fit if we were to have a new domestic terror law enacted in the next administration?
Yeah, well, we don't know exactly what would be in it. I'm sure there are some things that have been on various people's wish lists for a while. I mean, the thing to keep in mind here, right, is that police already have tremendous authority to do all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And so they already have any tools they could need, but they will come up with stuff to expand their powers, to reduce accountability, reduce transparency, to give them more resources. So you'll see more money for Homeland Security, maybe more authority for preemptive surveillance, maybe, you know, more authority to hold people for questioning law. You know, they will try all kinds of stuff. And like I said, that will quickly pivot to be used against the left. Mm-hmm. So for the left, you know, we should, and of course, more broadly, right, the Biden team is going to put more money into policing. It's going to put more money into federal policing under the guise of getting gangbangers and getting drugs off our streets and the same kind of nonsense that Biden was part of in the 94 crime bill. Mm-hmm. But it's also going to create more money for local policing under the guise of community policing and police reform. And we're going to hire more black police officers. So we're going to give you money for that. Mm. And at the core of this, right, is this central political problem, which is that political leaders have been turning political problems into policing problems rather than actually addressing them. Mm. So rather than really going after the political base of these right-wing movements with a robust agenda for social transformation, they're going to turn it over to the police. And rather than really dealing with the underlying causes of youth violence, drug involvement, et cetera, which are rooted in the austerity politics that they have created, they're going to turn it over to police. And that's the core issue here. Whenever we see a problem turned over to police, we should be looking for the political failure that undergirds that. What political chicanery is being facilitated by giving this problem to the police? And Biden has given every indication he's going to continue on that path by the people he's appointed, you know, and the kinds of statements he's been making. So it's incumbent on the movement to reject this politics, to continue to say, no, we want actual solutions to our problems that lift people up, that empower communities, that restore health, rather than just putting more people into the criminal legal system to be chewed up and spit out.
Yeah. It's just, it really just comes down to addressing material conditions of people's, like, where they live and how it is. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And yeah, this real emphasis on, I don't know, I just feel like the arguments that people have, and I feel like the conversation as it's represented often in, we call it mainstream media or whatever, is it's usually just like they want clear black and white things, and it's so much more complex, and it really just comes down to, yeah, like you said, just everything you just laid out there, it really comes down to all of that. And so
Look even like at the Flint water crisis. So we got notice this week that the then governor is going to face some kind of criminal prosecution. And everyone's like, oh yay, accountability.
Yeah.
But people still don't have clean water.
Yeah, right.
And the people who are orchestrating this prosecution could actually get people clean water. But that's too expensive. It's too difficult. So instead of actually solving the water problem, they're going to throw some admittedly despicable characters into the criminal legal system where they will get a slap on the wrist. And then they can be like, see, justice was done. But people still don't have clean water.
Right.
So this is the problem we're facing.
Yeah.
We got to keep focused on the clean water, getting people what they really need, not the theater of punishment.
Yeah. I was reading, I think you had shared it on your Twitter. It was some... I wish I could remember the details, but it was in Brooklyn, I think, and they're changing like how they're doing policing. They're like kind of doing a little bit of an experiment there. Would you be able to talk about that at all? Yeah.
Yeah. So this was something that was worked out in a local precinct, kind of somewhat independently. I don't know, maybe they got approval up the chain of command, but they picked a corridor in a fairly high crime area. And they said, for 5 days, we're going to kind of pull back the policing and we're going to instead turn things over to a robust kind of community-based organization response. So groups had a presence on the block, violence interrupters, community outreach people. And during that period, you know, there was no crime problems. The police didn't have to come rushing back in. And everyone said this worked really well. So now they want to try it again in another part of North Brooklyn and see how it goes. It's interesting, but it's not sufficient because having a few outreach workers is not the same as like actually getting young people into jobs, actually dealing with the legacies of traumas of interpersonal violence and state violence, right? Of securing people's mental health and getting them access to treatment. Right. So it's a good step, but my worry is if it's too superficial, then the first time there is a shooting while one of these experiments is underway, the right will just say, see, it doesn't work. Mm. This is namby-pamby nonsense. We got to bring back the police state. Mm. So we got to be careful about making claims for inadequate interventions that they're somehow going to solve all the problem for us. You know, this was a problem like in Seattle, they had this kind of liberated zone, but with no resources or infrastructure. So they had problems. Some of those problems were orchestrated by the police to try to undermine the thing, but also they did not have real mechanisms of governance, real mechanisms of service provision, real mechanisms of restorative justice interventions and accountability, you know, and we need those things.
Yeah.
We don't, we're not advocating some kind of free for all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, just points to just that we need a pretty clear analysis of the situation. And it is just about, you know, just thinking it through and having all the resources available and doing all the things, all the steps. And there isn't there isn't like a, I just think everyone's just thinking so, it's such a simple-minded way of approaching it. And I just feel like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what else to say. I just feel like there's just so much more that's needed as far as analyzing the situation. I think every city, every community is going to have its own context that have to be worked in, and it's just going to be different.
Each neighborhood, right? Each because neighborhood, the public safety needs of different neighborhoods are different. You know, some places have traffic fatalities and car break-ins, and other places have youth violence and open-air drug dealing, you know. So we need a nuanced response to these things. Mm-hmm. And we need a broad range of possible solutions that aren't just people with guns.
Right. Right. Reminds me, there was a press conference, I think, it was just a really good example of this, where there was a police chief who was like, look, all the resources that we used to have to take care of people have been cut, and it's been put all on us. And he's like, we're just not trained to do that. Like, that's not what police are for. And you've put this all on our shoulders. And it was just like, it was really succinct. He's very honest and very clear.
Yeah, I think you're referring to David Brown, who at the time was the chief of police in Dallas. Mm. And this was following the killing of some officers there. Mm. And he said, you know, we don't have any mental health services, so we send the police. The schools are failing, we send the police. We got a loose dog problem. They want to send the police, you know. We've turned every problem into a policing problem, right? And he's signaling this is a political failure. Mm-hmm. It's not a policing failure. It's a political failure. Mm-hmm. He didn't say it explicitly, but that's what he was signaling. So in that sense, we have a similar analysis, right? It's up to the politicians to solve these problems. Quit thinking the police are going to solve them, because we can't end homelessness. We, no matter what the police do, they cannot eliminate drugs or the harms of drugs or the damage of this. Just, they're incapable of doing that. Mm-hmm. Quit using them. Let's actually start addressing the problem. But it's been politically convenient to turn it over to police, and we have to make it no longer politically convenient. We have to extract a political cost for that.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a good place to end the interview. I think, thank you so much for going over all that with me. And I appreciate you very much and the work that you've done. What are you currently working? Are you have any upcoming projects or books or anything I can plug here at the end?
You know, people can follow me on Twitter at @avitali, and, you know, just working on a lot of projects, a lot of supporting, organizing. We do a lot of work against gang policing here in New York City. Mm. You know, so the best way to follow, they can follow me, or they can follow at Policing J for the Policing and Social Justice Project that I coordinate.
Okay. Well, I'll be putting links to everything, your Twitter, your website.
And there'll be a second edition of The End of Policing later this year.
Oh, okay. Great. All right. What changes are you making? Are there any
significant
changes?
There's going to be a big new introduction that takes into account what's happened over the last 3-4 years since the book was first written.
Okay. Is that published through Verso?
That's right.
That's right. Okay, cool. Yeah. All right. Well, great. I look forward to that. And yeah, I just really, again, appreciate you coming back on. It's good to have you back on after all this time.
You bet.
And yeah, I'll be putting all the resources in the description of the episode. So Alex, thank you very much for your time.
You're most welcome.